one phone call changes your life. You know what happens. The phone rings, you answer, and everything in your life changes. It might be good news, it might be bad news, but from that moment, everything is different. There is before the call and after the call. This episode features one of Europe's best undercover investigators, and it starts with a life-changing phone call. Except in this case, the investigator doesn't pick up the phone. The call is not for him. He's actually listening to a covertly taped call between a mobster and one of his sources. And the call is chilling. The investigator hears the source crying and begging for his life. And what he hears leads to an unprecedented multi-year investigation with high-stress tactical police raids in dozens of countries, hundreds of arrests and convictions, and it reveals widespread criminal match-fixing at the heart of international sports. Welcome to Crime Waves. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Crime Waves. My name is Declan Hill, and I'm an associate professor of investigations here at the University of New Haven. Each week, myself and my students, and this week, it is the brilliant Ryan Decker and Aidan Van Battenberg, bring you stories of investigators from around the world. In this mini season of Crime Waves, we're returning to blood sports. A professional passion, it's exposing the tsunami of corruption in modern-day sport. Our guest is Michael Barrs. He's a tough, no-nonsense cop who has the reputation of being absolutely fearless in taking down the criminals. His reputation grew when he became one of the lead investigators in the Bochum Boys case into match-fixing in international soccer. Good morning, good evening, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us on Crimewise Podcast. It's a real honor to have you here, brother.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure for me to speak to you, of course.
Listen, let's just get cracking right away. We were talking about this story. You're on your headset. You're listening to a match fixer talking in real time to a player. And it, your head just starts to explode. What happened? What's that story?
Yeah, it was absolutely crazy because our case starts with a drug dealing case. It has nothing to do with match fixing. At this time, I've never heard about match fixing. There was earlier scandals in football, but at this time for me, it was far, far away. And then I listen to the criminals. Normally, I expected a conversation about drugs, about some strange things in that, how they get the drugs from the others. And now I listen to a football player talking to one of those drug dealers, and they speak about, hey bro, let us meet again, and what's going on? Is the next game ready? And I thought, what happened? What really happened? And
were you thinking this was some kind of code that they were using soccer terminology for a drug deal? Was that what you're thinking?
No, I thought it is a ridiculous scene. That means maybe they know each other, but the football player didn't know what really happened or what his brother do. I listened, of course, carefully. My mouth were wide open, I think. And then they speak about paying each other. That means work for me. Let us do this thing like the last time. That means they do it again and again. And this was the first crazy. But at this time, I thought it was, I'm not really in this scene. I think the next step, they say, okay, that was a mistake, or they laugh, but it was reality. And then it goes on. That means they say, think about if you don't work for me, what happened? And Yes, bro. I know how important it is for you and so on. And this was the first time I really been touched of that strange thing. Yeah.
And your whole life is about to change dramatically from this one thing. We're going to get deep into the world of match fixing in European soccer, but tell me a little bit about this conversation. Is it one of those covertly recorded ones where you got a microphone hidden somewhere and you're listening to these guys don't know that you're recording it. Is that right?
Yeah, of course. It was absolutely undercover or top secret. They don't know that we listen to them, of course. This was part of our job. As the first conversation stopped, the next call goes inside to the fixer, and it has the same story. But the money they talked about was unbelievable. They say, okay, I place bets for your next game, 300,000 euros. And you know what you have to do. And the fixer don't have... or they don't have to tell the player what he had done because he know what he should do. So he only said, okay, next game. And he said, yes. And that was it. And then they talk about, is he fit at the moment or is he maybe injured or something like that. Yeah. And then after the call was stopped, the fixer called another criminal guy from the drug dealing scene and said, okay, all is safe, all is clear, let us do. And the crazy thing was the guy on the other side haven't any idea of soccer. The fixer named some teams, and I know it because I'm a big football fan, but the fixer don't know what is it. What is it, a club? Is it an injury? Is it... he don't know what really speak about, but he knows that he have to pay. And when the bet was good, then they receive a lot of money. So it was strange. This was the first time I ever heard about fixing it.
And at that point, you are only, I'm putting only in a quotation mark in that thing, but you're only an organized crime investigator investigating drugs. You didn't know, you weren't going out to investigate sports, you weren't going to investigate sports gambling, you weren't going to investigate match fixing, but this is the first moment of this investigation. And from there, I want to make sure that our listeners know, from this one conversation, it spirals huge. I mean, it really goes huge. Tell us, Michael, how big this case gets in soccer. How huge it gets.
Yeah, at the end, you are absolutely right. You said you are only working in organized crime. This is right. Typical organized crime cases like drug dealing, murder cases, human trafficking and such things, normal for police work, but never match fixing. And it was yeah, unbelievable. I think you can't tell it or you can't understand when you not really listen to them. It is really unbelievable because they are on the next day, the next 2 days and the next weeks, so many different players from so many different clubs are involved. And I asked myself, what happened? And all of our unit asked ourselves, what really happened? What are they doing? Money laundering, maybe money laundering. But for me, and of course, I have blue eyes, but I'm not such an idiot that I don't know what really is behind organized crime. But I never thought that sports or sportmen are so deep inside organized crime because the sport is their life and yes, they throw it away. And for me, it was unbelievable.
And just to, you know, and we're really going to unpack this and talk about match fixing and talk about how it can be stopped and all the kinds of things. But by the time your investigation goes to court, and there's many court cases, there's many trials, there's many arrests, many convictions, which is the gold standard for cops, you uncover hundreds of fixed matches, do you not?
Yes, of course. In the end, we investigate more than 300 fixed games all over the world. So this was crazy because we started in Bochum. I think nobody knows Bochum really. Mm-hmm. And
And Bochum, then, by the way, for our listeners who don't know Germany, I've been there a couple of times. It's right in the middle of the industrial area of Germany. It's kind of like the Pittsburgh of Germany. If you're an American listener, it's a blue-collar, working-class town that had steel mills and coal, and it was it's a tough guy's town. You know, you think is that a fair description?
Yeah, it's a special area. I think if Bruce Springsteen make a song about Germany, he will sing about Bochum.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. Bochum is, it's the so-called Ruhrgebiet. That means Bochum, Dortmund, Essen, Gelsenkirchen. These are the towns nearby.
Yes.
And they living in football. That means everyone who's living there has a heart of a football player. And this was a special thing because now you are step into an unreal world. That means you touched by football players. They are well known and they are deep inside a criminal network, and they paid by them. They are absolutely, the criminals are the leaders of them. And this was, for me, I missed the right words to describe this because normally a football player is giving an interview and he is the tough guy. Everybody looks up at him. Every kid on the street wears his shirt with a name on the shirt with his number. And now there were one special thing. I listened to a well-known high player. He should fix a game. And of course, the football player couldn't play the worst game ever because after a couple of minutes, he will out of the pitch because
he'll be substituted. The coach will take him out. Yes, yes.
Right. And he plays good, and he give a pass through on, and the forward leads to a goal, and the game ends 1-0. But the criminal network and the player who gives the pass bet against his own team.
Holy moly. So he made an assist that scored a goal for his team. He didn't want to do it, but he did.
Of course not.
And now he's meeting the mobster, and you're listening. Right. What does this guy say to the mobster?
And I listen after the game. I listen to what happened on the pitch, and it was amazing to be part of that, but unbelievable, because they say, okay, the bad guy told him, I give you instructions and you fucker work against me. That means I destroy your career. And the well-known football player was crying. Give me one chance. We work together so much time, and I work every time for you. Give me another chance. Give me another chance. Blah, blah, blah.
So this famous soccer player star is crying because his organized crime thug. So everyone else in Germany salutes the big soccer playing star, says, hey, what an amazing guy you are. And in this conversation, after he's played well, he's crying in front of this monster.
Yeah, begging of course, because he has never a chance to get out of this criminal network. Never.
No, I just want to say, you say, of course, because you're an organized crime cop, that's what you've done for your career, is bust these guys, arrest them, throw them away. But myself and the listeners, there's nothing, of course, about this interview. These are our minds are being blown away. And I just also want to make sure that our listeners know, by the time you finish unpeeling the network, you guys discovered there were World Cup qualifying matches and Champions League games that were being fixed. Is that right?
Yeah, right. First, our Bochum case stops because the criminals have been sentenced to long prison terms. But At this time, it was four years ongoing cases, and I have at this time a big network from criminals, from journalists, from lawyers, from prosecutors, and they contact me because I'm now deep inside this criminal phenomenon, and then we go the next step. That means we leave Germany. We are now entering the European criminal countries of football. After that, we step into the next, and suddenly we find out we are worldwide investigators, and this is absolutely untypical.
Now, how many countries was this network, was this criminal network of match fixers touching? Two, three, five?
I think it was 24.
What? 24 countries these guys were working in.
Yeah. And the big thing is,
yes,
the thing leads to not only one person. There are different groups all over the world, of course. But what I'm very impressed was, they know each other, the criminals, not personal, but they have heard from them. And it is such a big network. So this is what I want to tell the public. It is,
yes,
not only because we make some arrestings. That means we have destroyed all the big match fixers. Promille. It was only one cent corn in this whole desert. It was nothing.
So, my mind, and you know, I did an undercover investigation in match fixing myself. But let me get this right. From this tough working class industrial town, as you say brilliantly, you know, if Bruce Springsteen was to write a song about Germany, it would be set in Bochum. And you're listening to these drug dealers. You've got no idea what's going on. And you pull this thread. And by the time you've unfinished raveling this thread, not only have you got a successful criminal convictions in Bochum, but you've got a network that's spreading 24 countries around the world, goes World Cup, goes Champions League. And you've only made a tiny, tiny bump in this network. It's still carrying on. It's still going on. Talk to us, if you can, Michael, about dealing with different law enforcement agencies around the world. What's it like dealing with non-German police forces?
Yeah, this is the biggest thing we have to deal with, because you have to know that if there are special laws in Germany, for example, that does not mean that they also apply abroad. That means if our law said, okay, you can wiretapping some guys, but we have to work with another Belgium, Denmark, Norway, for example, or the US.
America, US.
We have also suspicious games in America and Canada.
What? Okay, hang on a second. I can see you, the listeners can't. You're shrugging your shoulders like, you're doing that of course thing again, which I was talking about earlier, which is like, it's so normal for you as an organized crime investigator. You're just like, oh yeah, of course we had fixed matches in America and Canada. So you were hearing that this network was working in America?
Yes. And we try to work with the Canadian police together. This is what you ask for. That means, for example, if I'm a police officer in Germany and I know that there are some criminal activities in Canada, I can't fly to Canada and make my own business there and arrest people. That means I need a so-called letter of rogatory. I need help from the police in Canada. It depends how motivated the other guys are and if they have the same law like us.
So what was it like working with the Canadian police?
Yeah, I try to give my evidence we have to Canada. But after a couple of times, then it is on another level. That means prosecutors talk to each other and find some solution how they can work together. I think I don't know. I'm not investigating in Canada at the moment, but at this time for a couple of years or for some years, I ever get information that in Canada is something strange, and the criminals talk about suspicious games in Canada. Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to embarrass you. I know you're still an organized crime investigator. I know we were very lucky to get you. All of what we're talking about is in your recently released book, which is a fantastic book, by the way. I strongly recommend listeners, if you're engaged with this story, if you're finding this podcast interesting, please, at the end, we will make sure that you have a link to Michael's book with a German journalist. It's fantastic. But I did notice when I asked you about dealing with Canadian police officers, you were very polite, but there was a lot of shrugging going on there. And at the end, it sounds like nothing happened. There certainly wasn't any arrests in Canada.
Yeah, but this is a global problem in my eyes.
So it wasn't just the Canadian law enforcement community that didn't have an investigation. There were other places and other times.
I never heard about the result from Canada police, but that doesn't mean maybe they make the biggest arrestings all over the world, but I never heard about this. I think this is a global problem. For example, if I start an investigation or we start an investigation in Germany, I try to explain that we have different laws in other
yes.
countries. And the problem is when we need help from other countries, they have their own list what is important for them. A good example for me is ask the public outside, what should the police investigate? And ask 100 people, should the police work against burglars or match fixers? 100 from 100 will give you the answer.
Burglary,
yeah.
Or drugs, or murder, or rape, or yes, or, yeah.
Yeah, because they think they know what happens behind, but nobody knows what happened behind match fixing. And
why should police deal against match fixing? But let's answer that question. Why should they do that? Why should they fight against match fixing?
Yeah, because it's organized crime. That means the criminals are shooting each other. They shooting against other people. They make big pressure to the sports guys. I tell you about the guy who give the pass to lead the game 1-0, and I listen what happened. He was crying at the wiretapping, and he never will come out of this circle. But I want to explain how difficult it is sometimes. When I give evidence to other countries, that means it took a long time if you will get back an answer, or if they start their own investigation, or if the prosecutor tell me, okay, we have enough to do at the moment, we make it on point 16, and so on. But a good thing is, I only want to criticize everything. This is not what I want to do. There's in Europe, there's a solution at Europol, for example. It called JIT, Joint Investigation Team. That means you make a contract between different European countries, and then the letter of rogatory is very easy to handle. That means you can change the information by sending emails, or if we do this in our country. This is very easy, and this is absolutely helpful. And this is a step forward how we can solve this problem. But it is like in every time, it depends how motivated are the other guys. Yeah.
Let me backtrack and tell a little bit of a story. One is that the your colleagues in Spain and Belgium fought against the Armenian mafia, the Vora Zakoni, the Russian mafia, You know this story. I'm just making sure our listeners know, who were match fixing in tennis in a major, major way, and in handball and in basketball and in soccer, of course. And they put together what you're recommending, Michael, which was a joint force task force in 14 different countries across Europe. And on one morning at 5:30 in the morning European time, 14 different police agencies went through the door at the same time, smashing in the door, getting those guys and putting those guys away. Now, that trial is still ongoing in both Madrid and Brussels, and we're following that here at Crimeways very, very closely, and we'll have some of those guys on to talk about their work. I'd also just, Michael, before I get onto our next, you're such an interesting guy. There's so many things to talk about, but I did want to say, as a Canadian now living in America who knows match fixing, I can assure you there has never been a single arrest for match fixing in Canadian soccer. And the Canadian Soccer League was so bad for match fixing, Michael, that a couple of years ago, there was a game in the Niagara Peninsula. And the Niagara Peninsula is kind of little small area just outside Toronto. And the Canadian-based team was playing against a foreign-based team. And a lot of the foreigners were coming in from the Balkans in this particular team, and they were working for this fixing gang. And it was so obvious that they were fixing, the Canadian guys, who weren't very good, just said, excuse my language, screw this. We're going to fix the fix. We're going to score on our own goal. So they take the ball, they turn around from attacking the other guys, and they start running towards their own goal to score on their own goal. Well, the Balkan guys, the Croatians, the Serbians, the Bosnians, they go, whoa, man, if they score on their own goal, it screws up our fix. They start running down the field and try to stop the other team from scoring in their own goal. And then they grab the ball and they start running towards their own goal to score on their goal. So for the last 20 minutes of the game, Michael, the fixing is so bad in the so bad in the Canadian Soccer League that you had these two teams just making the whole game into a farce, trying to score on their own game. That's how bad fixing was in Canada, and there was never a single arrest.
It's comedy,
total comedy. Total comedy.
And one thing about that, what I asked myself, and I asked myself, why no more or only me? German fixers, well-known fixers, told me about games, suspicious games or manipulated games in Canada. So who or what is the link from Germany to Canada? And they told me that German fixers also went to Canada to fix games. And this is absolutely crazy. Only one sentence to the work together. The difficulty that arises is that, of course, you have to look carefully with whom you can work together across national borders also, because organized crime means that they are high-ranked people inside this business, politicians, police officers, prosecutors, and so on. So this is also a difficulty to work.
I remember I was talking to one guy who was building up a match-fixing case that had links to Turkey. So he sent the information, not he, but his office sent the information to Istanbul, and within 2 days, it appeared on the newspapers in all over Istanbul. So therefore completely ruining the investigation. So some corrupt police officer inside the Turkish police leaked it to the media so he could tip off his criminal friends.
We have the same problem in our case. That means I write a report, and the original report was in a big, big Turkish newspaper. The original report from me. So I asked myself, how goes this through Turkey
how can you trust the safety of your sources? Can you do that? I'm just asking this because the producer is asking me to this. He's an American, a brilliant student here at the University of New Haven. He wants to know if you've ever worked with the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigations. Have they ever come over and asked for information from you guys about match fixing here in America?
I work with the FBI together at one time, and I give my evidence to them. It was, we do.
And again, our viewers can't see Michael's face. Michael has a very friendly, open face for a tough guy. But when he doesn't want me to ask any more questions in that particular thing, there's this wall that comes up. And so I take that, the appearance of your wall is that you don't want me to ask any more questions about the FBI and which case or anything like that.
Yeah, because this is against my law, and I can't give you such information, of course.
Oh, fair play. If you don't mind, let's take a step back. We're having a conversation with you in your private office. There is, and Michael Barrs is a tough guy. There's a big punch bag just behind your back. They say that you're the Donnie Brasco of Germany. How did you get to become an organized crime police officer? Are you the only one in your family, or is all your family cops? What's your background?
Yeah, I come from a police family. My father, my brother, my uncle are also police officer. My wife is also a police officer.
Wow.
And so we are five guys at home. We could build our own unit. Maybe it would make things easier sometimes. Maybe not.
Or more difficult, yeah. Yes.
More difficult. I think more difficult because, yeah. Yeah, for me, I have two options in my life, a professional football player or a police officer. I'm too bad for a professional football player, so there's only one chance to grow up with. And my dream is to be a police officer, and I want to catch criminals. So I start working after my education in police in a normal police car.
Did that come from your dad when you were growing up? Your father was telling you these stories?
Yeah, I think I grew up by my grandparents. So I think I have all the freedom at home, but they try to teach me what is justice. Of course, I'm not right at every moment in my life.
I do a
lot of mistakes. But I think I want to help not so strong people. So for me, it was clear I will be a police officer. And I start in a normal police car wearing a uniform. It was also great, but my target was to fight against the biggest criminals. Step by step, after I had in my police life, I had to fight against windmills because I am like I am. That means—
Sorry, fight against windmills.
Yeah.
You're like Don Quixote, in other words. You're fighting for your ideals.
Yeah, right. It sounds crazy if someone is talking about himself and said, okay, I try to fight against windmills. That sounds crazy, but it is like it is. That means I have an idea. My target is to have success and to be motivated. And of course, you have good guys and bad guys, also by the police, and motivated
yes.
guys and not so motivated guys. And if you are a young cop, it is difficult to go your own way, but I think I have to go my own way. And this is what I mean with that.
And every police officer, undercover, overcover, uniformed, always tells me about those agendas and all those problems inside police forces all over the world. But your goal, Michael, from when you put on the uniform as a German police officer, was to fight organized crime.
As I wear a uniform, I'm normal in a police car working on.
But your ambition
street.
Is.
Yeah. Yes. Of course. That was my motivation to do that at one time, and now I think I'm 30 years a police officer, and since 20 years I'm working in an organized crime unit.
Now, there are different organized crime gangs and groups in Germany than there are here in America. But what's the worst one? What's the most powerful organized crime group in Germany?
I think I don't know if you can make a rank. I think if we ask the criminals, they always had big problems to talk about the Russian guys. They fear the Russian guys
because they're so violent. The Russian mafia is so violent. Yeah,
that's true. We had extensive legal proceedings against the Headshot Gang, the so-called Headshot Gang. That means we fight against a Russian mafia gang. They killed 7 people, and so on. And
why did the Headshot Gang? Why did they kill these 7 people?
They are also drug dealers, and they the violent people hasn't worked like they want, and this means the life is over.
Yes,
and this is what I mean. We have also in the match fixing case we have links to Russians, but our guys who I do my interrogation alone because I have a special level to the criminals, and they really told me a lot of things. But if we focus on Russians, they say, hey guy, I tell you everything, but not against Russians. So this is very special
because the organized crime guys in Germany are so scared of the Russians, they'll give up anybody else, but they're not going to give up the Russians.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Hey, listen, before we get back to match fixing, just a question, and I hope it's not too invasive, but is it easier that your wife is a police officer with all the stress? You know, you're fighting against these guys, you're doing these raids, you're doing these hardcore investigations. Is it easier that your wife is also a police officer because she understands it, or is it more difficult because it's like two people with that stress in the same room?
Okay, you all also has to ask her. In my eyes, but I think it's hard to live with me together. I think because I'm a little bit crazy. I'm 24/7 police officer, and you can call me up. 24/7. But we are married more than 25 years, so I think the connection is very good. And I think for me it is an absolutely advantage because she knows what happens. And if I said to her, okay, I come home later and much later, she knows what happened. And this is a big advantage. Yeah.
It's not as if she's outside the cops and you have to explain to her, but you can't explain too much. Yes.
I
remember meeting Donnie Brasco and his wife and that feeling of this being one team, two people, one team, and on that understanding going on. Let's get back to match fixing, and then we'll wrap up this interview. But please, Michael, I know the listeners really want you to come back and talk about other cases against the Russians and this, but I know we've got to focus on match fixing. If there was one way of stopping match fixing from going on in European sport, what would you say it is? How would you stop it?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of possibilities to reduce. You never will stop it because it's a criminal phenomenon like other things. You never will stop drug dealing all over the world. But you can reduce it if you want. And this is the reason why we don't stop it at the moment, because I think nobody's really focusing on it. What I would do is first, you have the Football Association. The Football Associations are the first guys who have to do their homework. That means the youth players, for example, they have to educate in match fixing. They have to know what is match fixing. They have to, you have to build up some confidential guys in a team, because if someone of the mafia goes to a youth player and say, hey, let us work together, and they don't do it wearing a black suit with sunglasses on and a suitcase with full of money, they are normal things how they get in contact with them, then the youth players, for example, become a feeling what is right, what is wrong. And when they will be asked about someone from the mafia, they need someone who can explain what happened. If they go to whom they should go, and this is one point. Then betting is not illegal And if I said, okay, betting and sport is not such a good connection, everyone will shout at me because they say, okay, betting is not legal. What are you telling us? But it's the same. I have a daughter. And if I and alcohol and nicotine are also not illegal, but I educate my daughter that it is not so good for her. And the same in betting. I can't advertising or make advertising for betting. And betting is the first step into match fixing. So I see a lot of well-known football players. They make advertising for betting companies, but I never see one football player who make advertising against match fixing. So I can't understand this.
I you know what, I wish, and I think what I'm going to ask the producers to do, that's my amazing students this term, that's Ryan Decker and Aidan Van Battenberg, I'm going to ask them to make a short telegram of this last 2 minutes, because here in America, they've just legalized sports gambling. And state by state, they're declaring this. And there's zero conversation about match fixing. There's zero conversation about gambling addiction. And I'm like you. I think sports gambling should be legal, but people should be educated about how dangerous it is.
Yes, of course. And the thing is, it is illegal to place bets if you are under 18 years. But I found out that every youth player, 14, 15, 16, plays bets a lot of times. They addicted sometimes. It is unbelievable. But and this is what I don't like. If you tell this to the Football Association said, okay, what should we do? We are no investigators. And I said to them, that is wrong. You have the sport laws. I am for the normal law. But you have the sports law and you have to do your homework with that. You can report a football player. Have you done this? And he said, no. And you say, okay, then it's over. Or you go deep inside this case. You make questions in this club. You ask the trainer, the coach, you ask the other people, and they don't do it because they don't want a big scandal.
And I think that, listeners, you can't see my face, but I am nodding so hard, I'm gonna injure my vertebrae here. Gambling addiction is the silent plague of modern day athletes. So many of the young athletes, be it in basketball, be it here in America, are gaming and gambling addicts. And that's the first step into match fixing. Listen, Michael, we're almost out of time. I really want to thank you for, first of all, your work. It's amazing. You and what I call the Bochum gang, that's my joke, the match anti-match fixing investigators in Germany have done an amazing job. Thank you for your time today. Please, I know myself and the listeners would love if you would come back and talk some more.
Yeah, thank you so much that you give me the chance to give you an overview of what really happened. And I'm so proud to be here. And if you have another podcast, let me know. I'm there.
Thanks. Thank you so much. Dankeschön. Guten Abend. And we're going to make sure listeners, please, if you got any German or you want to go through with Google Translate, we're going to put a link to Michael Barr's book. That's B-A-H-R-S, Michael Barr's book. We'll bring that in and we'll link it up and stuff. It's a fantastic book. It really uncovers all the stuff that was going on. Thank you again, Michael.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And one question or one sentence. If the audience have some question, they can contact me via my homepage. I will answer all the questions if they like. Yeah,
and Michael, can you tell them your webpage? That's matchfixingweb.de?
It's www.matchfixing.de. That's right.
And for any of the idiots who are out there, and there's very, very few of our listeners, 99% of my listeners are geniuses and brilliant and love this program. But for the 1% idiots, because I too get these guys on my Twitter feed, this is not tips on how to match fix, nor on games that you should bet on that are match fixed. This is how we stop match fixing. Right, Michael?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not the 1%.
Dot man. Thank you again. Thanks again, Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Declan.
Hey, this is Declan Hill. We wrapped up that interview with Michael Barrs, and then, as happens frequently, the team began chatting and Michael started another story. We think you should hear it. It's about the Russian mafia and how they actually operate.
If you are interested, 1 minute, I could give you one thing that really happened.
Yes, please.
One of those headshot gang. He drives to the Netherlands because his plan was to shoot three guys, and they go into the house and they let him in, and then they have to go on their knees and they shoot them in the head, all the three guys. Then he leaves the house, step into the car, start the car, and then a police car drives because his backlight was damaged. And the officers go out this car and said, hey, police, give us your license, driving license and so on. Leave the car, you have a damaged backlight and so on. And his gun was smoking. And the guys, the police said, okay, thank you, make it clear, goodbye. If they do more than this, those guys will be killed.
Thank you so much for listening. This is Crime Waves. My name is Declan Hill. The production team this week is Ryan Decker and Aidan Van Battenberg. And please do come back next week for another episode of Bloodsport. That's the season that we're doing about crime and corruption in modern day sports.